to the Yavin Academy and the OU Parenting Night, the second session. I'm sort of following Dr. Blumenthal around. As I introduced him in the first session in the gym, I see a lot of new faces. That's great because you got a chance to hear from a really great speaker. Take some evidence back with you and some statistics back with you, as well as some things that we can use as parents. So Dr. Blumenthal comes to us as a well-known clinical psychologist in private practice in New York, specializing in adolescent and group therapy, and he coordinates the group psychotherapy training at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. And his topic for this evening, the second one, is nurturing spirituality and idealism in a culture of immediate gratification and materialism. The topic sounds really interesting, it's very long, but you'll see, and I heard it firsthand last session, he really comes with points that make all of us walk out of here with something we can do this evening or tomorrow with our children. So without taking up any more of his time, Dr. Blumenthal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Can I put this back in here, or is it so I can talk with my hands? Okay. One of my favorite stories when I was young, I'm going to age myself a bit, but my great-uncle went to Israel at a time when it wasn't so popular to go to Israel. I was a little kid, and he used to tell this story over and over again, how he was in Tel Aviv, and he had to find a certain site, and he found a guy walking down the street with two avatiach, you know, two Israeli watermelons, big Israeli watermelons. And he stopped and said, how do you get to so-and-so street? And he motioned that he needed his hands. And my great-uncle goes into great detail how he handed over one watermelon. Now my great-uncle's holding that watermelon. And he carefully hands over the other watermelon. Now my great-uncle's standing with two watermelons. And he says, lo yodeo. So I do need my hands. And the topic actually, you know, in the introduction, was mentioned, that I do this work at LHJ. But probably the more germane to this topic is another very interesting position, a very interesting job that I have. Which I'm not sure Rory Penn knows that, but I am the educational director of the Wexner program at YU. And this is the Wexner Kollel and Smicha Honors program is a very generously endowed program for the elite of the Smicha program. And on Fridays, they have a whole bunch of courses, courses in rabbinic writing, public speaking, in leadership, in mediation. And along with running that program, I co-teach the pastoral psychology course with my friend and colleague David Pelkovitz to prospective Smicha students. And we cover areas of depression and counseling and divorce and abuse and all that, but we do spend some time on the whole psychology of religion, on concepts of psychological concepts of happiness and spirituality. So that's an area where I've been forced to think and address this, and some of the research studies that I've come across, which I will cite, really come from that work that I do. And it's a very exciting work because these are, as you can imagine, these are very bright boys and willing to challenge and question. And it's a very exciting work. The story that I always like to try to start with a story, and the story that I think comes to my mind as we try to talk in terms of instilling idealism and spirituality in our children, was actually a story of a cousin of mine, Nebuch, who was one of the victims of 9/11, Shemi Beagleisen, some of you may know. Shemi grew up in Borough Park. And as a young child, he once was angry at his parents, upset about some discipline or something that they forbade. This goes back in time when parents used to forbid things. And he figured he threatened them with the age-old child threat, which is, I'm going to run away from home. When he saw that they weren't impressed, he figured he'd up the ante, and he said, I'm going to run away from home and become conservative. We certainly, as parents, while we want to raise well-adjusted children, and we want to raise children who can function well in this world, who have proper limits, etc., we also want children who have a sense of spirituality and idealism, because that's part of being religious. So it's really an integral part of our parenting. And what I'm going to try to address today is some basic concrete things that we do. Some are going to sound very simplistic, that we know from research promotes this kind of idealism and spirituality. But just as a way of starting, and I know there's a little bit of a time constraint, anybody want to take a stab? How do you define spirituality and idealism? What is spirituality and idealism? Or do you want to define each separately? Anybody want to take a stab at it? What is it? Here, go ahead. No? Okay. We should know what we're talking about. What is spirituality? Let's start with that. What is spirituality? What's spiritual? How many people feel that they've had spiritual experiences? Wow. Okay, a little bit. Okay. All right. It just shows you, because our world is runs so contrary to spirituality. I'm sure that if I had asked this question in the shtetl, or if I had asked this question of the Ovos, I mean, they certainly wouldn't have had much of a problem. Spirituality means a experience of something beyond this world. Actually, it comes from really from the term of spirit, which is like a, you know, this, we talk about the spirit in a person. But it's experiencing something beyond what we concretely, and we in a very immediate sense, experience. Hopefully, and I can't say I always have successfully, but let's say when the chazan starts on Yom Kippur night, sings Kol Nidre, we're having an otherworldly-like experience. We're thinking about God. We're having something that's experience that's beyond what's happening immediately. Or when we hear the shofar blowing, that's a spiritual experience. I mean, I think those are very extremes, but those are spiritual experiences. And that's something we want to imbue and experience in our children, because that's part of being religious. That's part of being having belief in God. It's not to say, oh, there's a God up there, but to have these experiences. And idealism, I think idealism also means that to believe in something beyond, to care about something beyond yourself. To sort of leave yourself and worry and care about something else, some other cause. To be concerned that, that in Sderot, I mean, Baruch Hashem, it's not a current anymore. But what it must be like to live in Sderot and want to do something about it, even though we're sitting here in the comfort of New York or New Jersey, you know, but to care, think about it and care about it and want to do something about it. So it's a kind of leaving yourself. It's a kind of taking yourself away from your immediate concerns, interests, and satisfaction to worry and concern yourself with something else. And how do we instill it in ourselves? I guess will be an interesting question, but how do we, or let's hopefully we've done it to some extent, how do we instill it in our children? And again, as the title suggests, particularly complicated, and maybe that's why it's so hard for us to define it or think about it, in a world which really works contrary to that, in a world which promotes immediate satisfaction, a world which promotes a tremendous amount of materialism, that happiness is derived by what you own and what you possess. Just to give you an example, and it's a little bit something I wasn't even going to go into, but I'll mention it. About 9 years ago, a psychologist woke up and said, for years and years, we're studying why people are unhappy, why people are depressed. Let's study why people are happy. And they decided to study happiness. And they couldn't call it happiness because that doesn't sound scientific, so they called it SWB, subjective well-being. Which means happiness, okay? And they did a huge international study, thousands and thousands of subjects, to find out what makes people truly happy. And they came up with the three Fs. Okay, three things that start with F. Okay? Anyone want to take a step? What? Food? No, only the Jews and Italians. No. Fun? No. Family? Friends? Very good. You read the article. What's the third? Nobody gets the third. Huh? Faith. I can't hear you. Faith. Yeah, I see you know the study. Right. Friends, family, and faith. In other words, you have a good cluster of friends, and you have close family relationships, and you belong to a shul, a lahavdil, a church, or a mosque, because that's how they measured faith, by belonging. You are a happy person, okay? As we used to say in yeshiva, what's the tzad hashav v'beinayim? What do they all have in common? And don't tell me they all start with F, right? What do they all have in common?
People.
Connections. You belong. You're part of something. And by the way, if you ever speak, I don't know if there's any Balei Tshuva here, but when I talk to Balei Tshuva, one of the things that comes across again and again from Balei Tshuva is, when you find out, why did you do this? I mean, why did you volunteer to pay, $65,000 a year in tuitions? Like, why are you doing this? And one of the things they will say is, I'm part of something. I belong to something. I'm not just this in my own little orbit. That true happiness doesn't come from owning things, doesn't come from big bank accounts. And by the way, the research shows it consistently. No connection with money, except in extreme cases of poverty. That money has nothing to do with happiness. But it's bred by a connection, by belonging to something, by feeling a connection with someone else, by feeling a connection with the community, by feeling a connection with Sderot. Another, by the way, interesting study in happiness that came out of this, a very interesting study, was they found, there was an article written that was called The Tyranny of Freedom, that found that when people have too many choices, they're depressed. That true happiness is bred by choices within a limited confine, within a corral. And that if you give your kids, like if you open up a closet with 30 clothing and say, pick what you want to wear today, you're breeding depression. Children will be happier if you pick out three things and say, pick from those three. That's in fact, by the way, they found even that Procter & Gamble had once, I think, 17 different types of head and shoulders and sales went down. And when they confined it to fewer types of head and shoulders, the sale went up. So again, that breeds unhappiness when we have too much. We have too many choices. Or if you say, what do you want to do on vacation? And you line up, we can go to Orlando, we can go to Barbados, you know, we can go, you know. That makes someone depressed. Doesn't make them happy. Hmm? Okay. So we live in a society where materialism emphasizes, we live in a society where there has to be immediate satisfaction. Everything has to be fast, even today, with the internet and with faxes and with microwaves. Everything has to come quickly, has to come right away. We don't live in a society that promotes delays, and we live in a society that emphasizes immediate satisfaction. By the way, even in sports, you're hearing more and more, whether it's steroids or cheating or et cetera, where athletes who we're supposed to, we want our kids to admire instead of sportsmanship, are doing what ensures a win. Irregardless of the consideration of other people. I remember a number of years ago, I was listening, it must have been a long time ago, because the Knicks were in the playoffs, so it must have been a very long time ago. But at any rate, there was a power forward on the Knicks, and I'm forgetting even the name, but at any rate, and he knocked down another player, and that happens. And usually you extend your hand and lift the player up. And instead of extending the hand and lifting the player up, this guy straddled the guy, stood on top of him, and scowled at him and cursed at him. And
Anthony Mason.
Anthony Mason? Okay, could be. I don't remember. And Pat Riley, I think, was the coach of the Knicks then, to show you how long. And the announcer, I'm expecting the announcer to say, this is terrible. So he said, well, that's Pat Riley basketball for you. It was a heksher to do such unsportsmanlike conduct to win. So how do we counter that, and how do we promote a certain ideals? And by the way, let me just share with you one study. This here, last time I excited more studies. Let me show you one very interesting study, which is the annual UCLA and American Council of Education survey of nearly 250,000 students entering college. In terms of what their goal is entering college. Okay? In 1965, 82% said developing meaningful philosophy of life was essential, versus 42% said being well off financially. 1998, only 35% endorsed meaning in life, and 74% said being well off financially. So we see the shift in terms of the emphasis of needing this kind of financial enumeration. One more thing also, by the way, which is so typical for today, and I remember it struck me on a very special vacation my wife and I took 2 years ago to celebrate a certain event, and we went to the Canadian Rockies, something I recommend if you want a spiritual experience. It's magnificent. It's beautiful. And we really went around on our own, but there was one part, the Columbia Ice Fields, which to me was the biggest disappointment, where you have to go on a bus, and you have to go on a tour group. And one of the things struck me, you're driving in the most magnificent scenery in the world. And there's nothing else. They describe what you're seeing. And then they just start chatting and talking. And they won't shut up for a minute. I want to just look, take it in. But it's like we need to be constantly entertained. And I started dawning on me when I was the first time I realized that that's typical also today. We need constant entertainment. Wherever you are, you have to constantly, even between innings and a ball game, if you take your kids to a ball game, there has to be this episode, this and this thing on the screen and that's on the screen. Why can't you just sit back and think? And that's spirituality, when you stop back and think and you consider. And that's also, I think, what works against raising children with idealism and spirituality. So let me give you some basics how we who want to do this, who want our children to be spiritual children, who want our children to be idealistic, some of the things we can do, and it's all, in a way, it's very going to be very simple. Number one, teach delay. Teach that you don't get things right away, always. And sometimes don't even get it at all. Or you have to wait. You have to say no sometimes, even if you don't need to say no. Children need to hear no, or they need to hear later. Not always. Sometimes they're entitled right away. And sometimes they have to wait. Sometimes they have to earn it. It doesn't have to be everything. But you don't get everything you want right away. And that's the message that they're going to hear all over the place. And we can say no, even, as I said, even if you don't have to. It's a very valuable message. You'll get it tomorrow. You'll get it later. We'll see how you do. We'll see this. Again, not everything, but be aware and teach them that they have to wait sometimes. Very important. If our children are watching TV, or if they're reading some of the general literature and they're exposed to commercials, and again, I mentioned this the last group, and I'll say it again here. The brilliant psychologist didn't travel in a pouring rain an hour and a half from Cedarhurst, New York, to Paramus, New Jersey, to talk about idealism. Brilliant psychologists are on Madison Avenue and are constructing commercials and trying to convince our children to purchase and buy and own things that they don't need at all. And they're doing it in very insidious ways. And if your child is exposed to commercials, and by the way, there's even research showing that they're not only, and this was what I spoke about in the last group, not only are they trying to get you to do it, but they're trying to teach children to be more, to override parents.
to undermine parents and get what they think is important for them. And there's a lot of trickery. If your child is exposed to commercials, watch a commercial with them and help the child be an active viewer. Help the child be an active consumer. Explain to the child, even what the supermarkets are, you know about impulse buying, right? Where's all the candy bars? Right by the cashier. Where's the milk? You know, all the way in the back, you know, because you got to get milk, you know, and so you have to go through all the other stuff to get the milk. And of course, while you're standing in line, that's where the candy bars are. Explain this to your children. Explain what the world is doing to us, that they want us to buy this candy right now. Therefore, they're putting it by the cashier. Or look at, and in fact, if you have I know this is for younger children, but if you have adolescent children, take a commercial from Time Magazine or something like that, or something they just saw, and say, how are they trying to get us to purchase something that we don't want? Even perhaps if they're old enough to look at the sexual innuendos. They're amazing. You do it yourself. Take the commercials, the sexual images, and the sexual innuendos are there all over the place, and you don't even realize it yourself. And it's an inadvertent kind of, it's propaganda. It's classic propaganda. I mean, if I want to sell Fox Ledge Spring, whatever, heard of this. Okay, I want to sell Fox Ledge Spring Water. I'm not going to stand and say, guys, buy Fox Ledge Spring Water. It comes from a very nice source, and it has more, what does it have? It has zero fat, zero sodium. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not going to sell it. But if I want to sell Fox Ledge Spring Water, what I'm going to do is create a scene of people who are absolutely gorgeous. And they're at a beach, and they're having the time of their life, and they have drop-dead bodies, and they're running around, and they're smiling, and they're jumping, and derech agav, they happen to be drinking Fox Ledge water. I'm going to sell Fox Ledge water. Now, our kids need to know that. So they're not duped. So they're not duped into these kind of immediate gratifications. Not only is it important to delay, but it's important to encourage a long-term time perspective. And we're seeing this less and less in children. And this, by the way, is researched also. Children are thinking less and less about what's going to be in the future. They're just not, it's called actually foreshadowing in the literature. But they're not thinking, I mean, kids for many years used to imagine what it's going to be like when I grow up, and what it's going to be like when I get married, where am I going to live, and what am I going to, kids aren't talking about that. And again, that takes you beyond right now. And there's nothing wrong with talking to a kid, even though they may have, well, no, I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player or something, whatever, you know? Oh, what do you think that's going to be like, you know, whatever. But to teach them to think a little bit in the future and think beyond right now and think where things are heading. You change their time perspective. And again, our world, our kids are not thinking like that. Another thing, very important, and you've probably heard this in any parenting workshop, but we'll say it again and again. It becomes very important in the crazy times that we live. Spend time with your child. We no longer live in a world where dad works from 9 to 5, comes home, and spends the evening home. Nobody, first of all, everybody has 3-4 jobs, and they have to today because of their expenses. I mean, unfortunately, and I'm no exception. I mean, Penn didn't get to half my jobs, you know. It's a reality. And then, it's not bad. The kids are busy as can be. They're in school till some sort of ungodly hour, and then they have karate and dance and gym and underwater basket weaving, and they have all these extra and nobody's ever home. You know, there you come home, this one leaves, and that one leaves. And there's never a time when the family's together, except Shabbos. And what happens Shabbos? Friday night, everybody's exhausted and in the worst mood. And by the way, let me dispel the myth right now. Everybody thinks everybody else's family Friday night are singing Zmiris and saying Divrei Torah, and the Kruvim are flying around over the table. And as my mother said, Gleibnisht, you know, it's not happening. Everybody's killing each other. Everybody's miserable, exhausted. And by the way, one more thing, and I know I'm talking in a school, but one thing I want to get rid of is sheets. Okay, and I'm not talking about linen. You know the sheets, right? Your kids come. Every single kid comes home with a Divrei Torah. Beautiful Divrei Torah. The teachers spend a lot of time on it, right? And they're all in Hebrew, which nobody can read or understand, you know? And the first grader doesn't want to hear the sixth grader's run. And before you know it, you're killing each other at the Shabbos table. Please, sign the sheets. I give you permission to lie. Sign the sheets. They read them beautifully. And then sing a song or a little cute little Divrei Torah. I mean, the sheets are driving. I make a lot of money on it because I have a lot of family sessions from sheets. But, you know, but all right. And that's Friday night. And Shabbos, we invite friends over. And the kids eat salami in the kitchen around. But we don't spend time with our children. We have to spend time. These spirituality, and again, idealism, spirituality is bred by spending time with parents and discussing certain things, as I will talk about in a minute. And by the way, research shows, again and again, families that eat dinner together every night every problem under the sun is less. There's a zero instance of substance abuse in the kids. Reading scores of children whose parents eat dinner together every night are higher. Now, I know it's not realistic, but there are ways to spend time. You have sometimes, in today's world, you have to create it. You know, when you walk to shul with your kid, or before they go to sleep, sit down with them for 10 minutes and talk. I want to tell you personally, I had a kid who was kind of hard, now older, but when he was going through high school, he was going through a rough time. I know how I had, as we call in yeshiva, an einfall like this, but I said to him, you know what? I'm going to give you a half hour sleep. I'm going to drive you to school every morning. And those 10 minutes in the car made the world of difference. 10 minutes in the car in the morning. And that's, in fact, I remember once speaking, and I was talking about the spending time with children. And I had one parent around my age come to me afterwards. You know, those are the best ones that come after. As soon as she sees me, she starts crying, tells me that her father just passed away, and she wants to share with me a story about her father. What's the story with her father? You know how it is, like, you know, you come home, it's, especially now that Shabbos is so early, men, you come home 20 minutes before Shabbos, you want to run into the shower, get ready and go, and suddenly your wife realizes she doesn't have asparagus. Oh my God, how am I going to get asparagus, right? You have to run and get asparagus. So you're going to run to the store now and quickly get some asparagus, right? You're just about to run, and your four-year-old comes and says, Daddy, can I go with you? No. She said, no matter what he was doing, every time she'd come to her father and say, Daddy, can I go with you? He'd say, sure. And he'd take her with her. And that's spending time together. That's time to just talk and share things and point things out and point out the impulse buying or whatever. We have to make time to be with kids. And it's something it's an avoda now. It's not something that we can sort of take for granted anymore. Not only take time, and this is a very, and believe it or not, this is, again, we're talking about leaving yourself. You're talking about thinking about someone else. One of the ways, let's use the Sderot example. Sitting here in Teaneck and thinking about people who are getting bombed every day. How do you do that? And one of the ways you do that is making your child's interests your own. Take an interest in your kid. Let me tell you a typical example, okay? You're leaving for work that day. You have 14 meetings. You have tons of stress. You're not going to sure how you're going to have money for the mortgage. And as you're leaving, you know, your kid says to you, Abba, I have the Chumash test today. Okay? You come home hours later, right? This is why God made these things, PDAs. As soon as you leave, you go into your PDA and write with six alarms right before you come home and say, ask Bracha about the Chumash test. And when you come home, you walk through and you see, how was the Chumash test? Do you know what you just taught her? You just taught her. We think about other people. When we love someone, we think about other people and we make their interests our own. Now, you couldn't care less about the Chumash test. But this to her, I mean, it would be great if we could remember it. But that's important. And seriously, with our children, it's true of spouses too, but certainly with our children. Whatever they're into, as silly as it is, make it your own interest, ask about it, take an interest in it, in their friends, etc. And you're teaching them not to think only about themselves. I want to tell a beautiful story about my father, and it's really a way to honor my father, who in Kanaina Har in 2 weeks is going to be 91 years old and doing very well. I grew up in a community, we're all immigrants, and I'm older than you guys, so you probably can't relate to it, but they were all immigrants, many Holocaust survivors. In fact, I had one friend who had American-born parents who once asked his parents, how come they speak English funny? Because they're the only ones that didn't speak with an accent. And when we were older, we wanted to go to baseball games. So we would ask our parents, take us to play. I remember one of my friend's father, who was a real greener, you know, he took us to Yankee Stadium, he bought the tickets, he sat us down, he took out the Allgemeine Journal, and he sat and he read. What does he care? I came to my father, who was also an immigrant, wasn't a survivor, my mother's a survivor, but he came to my father, and I said, I want to go to a baseball game. My father looked at me and says, I don't know anything about baseball. And we took a 2 to 2.5 hour Shabbos afternoon walk, and I taught him baseball. And it's a complicated sport. You know, you can steal second, but you can't steal the guys in second. You can't steal first. I mean, you know, if it's a fly ball and it's two outs and it's a ground, then it's automatically an out. Even if the guy doesn't catch the ball, you can tag up. And my father's a well-developed thumb, and he's asked me questions. We're going through Rishonim and Acharonim, and he wouldn't take me to a baseball game until he understood baseball. And then when I lost interest, he lost interest. You know, but when as long as it was interesting to me, he made it his own interest. That teaches idealism. Now, I'll tell you the sequel of the story because it's kind of cute. I asked him to go to a basketball game. I teach him basketball. Then I said, I want to go to a hockey game. Well, that was pretty easy because hockey is like soccer. It's the only sport he knew. So it was pretty easy to explain to him. And we went to a Ranger game. And this was a Gesunder Ranger game. There were fights. People were carried out in stretchers. Guys were throwing by the fights in the aisles. You know, it was really, it was bloody. It was a mess. And I could tell he didn't enjoy it. And we took the whole subway ride home. He didn't say a thing. And finally, we come home. We walk in. My mother says, "Nu, how was it?" And he shrugs and says, "Go yeshanachas." So that was the last hockey game. But that's how you breed idealism. Make their interests your own. Also, be concerned. express concerns about other people. And this is what we're going to talk about. This can be the topic of conversation, not just what the stock market is doing or nowadays not doing. What's going on? What it must, can you imagine what it must be like to never know when bombs fall? To get a red alert and have to, can you imagine that? Or when you're reading the Chumash, read today's Parsha, can you imagine what it was like for the brothers when they heard this, or for Yaakov? Let them picture it, let them imagine it, not just what's going on right now. And talk about that. Again, I'll share a personal story because they're easier, but I think it's very relevant. I grew up in a very mixed up family. My father was a Yek and my mother was a Holocaust survivor and a Hasidish family. Very mixed, very confused. My mother had a cousin who lived in New Square, a very special guy. And we used to go schlep up to New Square to visit, and there were very few relatives, so the one or two that we had, we would. And, you know, we'd come up there, and one of the kids we'd send to Beis HaMedrash to schlep him back, so he could, and he would greet us. And my father had an elderly father who lived in Washington Heights, real yuck, and this man knew that my father had an elderly father, and every time when he'd come to my father, he'd say, "Wie ist der Tata?" And how's your father? He knew he had an elderly father, and he asked after them. I was a little kid and I witnessed this. This man died when I was 18. To this day, if I have a friend who is an elderly parent, I don't have to think about it. I will ask them, and I see them, and I haven't seen them in a while, I say, "How's your father doing? How's your mother doing? How's your parent?" It's just automatic because I saw it. I saw a man who, from a totally different culture, but knew that my father had an old parent and asked after him. Something is, again, these things are so simple. But if your kid sees it, if your kid sees you asking someone else regarding a relative who's not well, who's having a hard time, or something like that, and they witness it, they're learning idealism. Thank yous. Do you know that there's a ton of research now on gratitude? And how kids who are taught to say thank you, kids who are taught to experience gratitude, grow up to be more fulfilled, happy adults. This is studied. Just saying thank you. I don't want a show of hands, but how many of us, when we're at a restaurant or we're at a simcha and the busboy comes and collects the plates, we turn around and say thank you? Why not? Something so simple. You do. Okay, great. But I'm saying it's something, and let the kid say, or tell the kid that. Tell the kid to say thank you. Or something, and especially not, you know, when you give them, you know, a wee and all right, we get a time. But sometimes when you give them lunch, like you do every morning, to say thank you, the same peanut butter and jelly sandwich. To say thank you. That's, you know, we talk spiritual. I want to talk about gratitude to God. You know, that we have to be grateful for every, and not to take, by the way, that should be a topic of conversation. There's nothing wrong with every once in a while stopping and saying, I do this. Do you know what wonderful times we live in? We have medical treatments for just about things that people died of. I mean, not so long ago, people died of infections. We have penicillin. If a kid has a strep throat and he goes to the bubble gum medicine for the 48th time that year, you know, and you know how wonderful it is we have this medicine? Not so long ago, my grandfather had a sister who died of a ruptured appendix. I mean, today it's nothing. We live in great times. That we live in a government that protects us. There's no pogroms. There's no attacks on us. You know, we're allowed to practice religion. Do you know how wonderful it is that we can, you know, when I met Long Island Jewish, they can make, you know, the African-American receptionist gets in the microphone every day at 2 o'clock and says, "Minka service is in the chapel," and all the Jews go running for their minks. You know, it's an incredible time just to bring it up. Then nothing should be taken for granted. And by the way, even something you once had and no longer have, and especially today with the recession, that we can't afford this anymore. Instead of being disgruntled that you don't have it, be grateful for all the years that you had it. There's a great story they tell about the Chafetz Chaim, an unbelievable story they tell, that, you know, the Radin, the town where Chafetz Chaim was literally destroyed in World War I. HIAS, the American charitable organization, used to send stipends to the towns that were decimated in World War I, the regular stipends, and this became one of the major sources of the budget for the yeshiva in Radin. When the 29 crash hit, the HIAS wrote a letter to the yeshiva and said, "Sorry, we can't anymore. We can't give you the stipend." So at that point, the Chafetz Chaim was like about 90 or something. They were afraid to tell him. And he died in 33. I mean, he was a very old man. They were afraid to tell him. But after a while, it became obvious that, you know, it wasn't the same kind of money. So they finally broke the news to him that this stipend from HIAS wasn't coming. He said, "Quickly, get me a pen, get me a letter. I have to write to them." And they figured that he was going to write to them, beg them to please continue. And he wrote a letter and he thanked them for all the years that they gave that money. That's a lesson. That's awesome. Be grateful for what you had. Be grateful, even if you don't have it anymore. Be grateful for what you had. teach them sacrifice. Sacrifice, what is an integral part of our worship as Jews is sacrifice, karbanos. Comes from the same word karov. You get close to someone from sacrifice. And by the way, it's a common mistake, and it's not our topic today. But one of the mistakes people talk about when they give the Shalom Bayis speeches, they talk about compromise. Compromise is when both people walk away miserable. You know, it's different. It's sacrifice. I'm going to forgo this for you. I'm going to give this up for you. Do you know, you want to breed idealism? You're about to go out and to play your golf game, and the kid, oh, he has a birthday party, and you put your golf clubs back. Good, I'll take you to the birthday party. You made a sacrifice. You made a sacrifice for someone else. We make sacrifices for God. If your child sees that you missed some business, there was a very important meeting, and you're going to lose money because you had to come home for Yontif, or you have to miss it. That's it. It's worth it. It's great. You teach them. That's why I give up. I give up. I forego something. Don't, or for that matter, don't complain about the tuitions. You know what? You know what you're telling you? Come in. Another tuition. My mom said, you should be happy to pay tuitions. I'm so happy. Look, you're getting a sheep education. You're teaching a kid that we give up, we sacrifice, and we forego things for some greater good. And giving. That giving is not painful. Giving is something that makes you happy, that enriches you. I want to tell you an incredible thing that happened, a recent study. There was a psychologist at, I think it was the University of Massachusetts, who had an idea that what she was going to do is she was going to identify certain people who are depressed, and she was going to get a volunteer to lavish this person and give them a lot of attention and gifts and take them out, and was hoping that maybe that would relieve them of their depression. So, identify a certain number of people depressed, and they got volunteers to come, and they would take them out to lunch, and they would buy them presents, and they would spend time with them, and treat them, and really lavish them. You know what they found? It didn't help the people who were depressed at all. They were just as depressed. But the volunteers felt great. The volunteers felt more fulfilled. That giving is, and you give with a smile. When you give to your kids, you give them with a smile. It's aser taser, the Gemara says, that you give, I forgot the exact language, vilshatis asher, you know, you'll be enriched by giving. When the guys come to the door for charity, and again, I know sometimes, you know, you're not sure who they are, whatever, but if it's right, it's legitimate, whatever, graciously give them. Give them with a smile. Give them graciously. It's a very good lesson for the kids. Another thing, very interesting, is give the kids chores. Give them things to, even if you don't need them. You have 16 housekeepers, it doesn't matter. Give them chores. There was a study, there's a fellow at Columbia named Luther who'd studied, did a very interesting study. It got a lot of attention, some of you may have heard of it. He compared not terribly impoverished, but poor inner city kids with the most affluent children in Westchester. And had some very interesting findings, and generally found that the inner city kids, again, not the ones really living in rundown tenements, but the relatively poor inner city kids were happier kids, basically, than the extremely wealthy kids in Westchester. And he identified a few reasons for this. One of the reasons he identified was that these poor kids had chores. They had jobs in the house. They had to pick up the kid's sister from school because both parents were working. They had to run down to the store and buy things. The wealthy kids in Westchester didn't have any chores. They didn't have a sense of giving. And by the way, found that the forced chesed projects, in other words, if they had to do something for extracurricular activities to make sure they get into law school, that didn't help because they were doing it for themselves. But the things that you just naturally have to do for someone else makes you a more idealistic person, makes you a happier person. So if we want to teach our kids to be idealistic, we want to teach our kids that when they grow up, they spend one night a week at Tom Chai Shabbos putting together food packages, teach them giving, and teach them, give them chores to do that are not self-serving. And last but not least, and then I'll conclude with a very beautiful story that just happened recently and gives us some time to have some questions and answers. Bring God into your discussion. Bring spiritual issues into your daily discussion. Talk about God. We have a relationship with God. We wonder about God. We don't understand God. But there's no reason why God can't be a topic of conversation at those times we're together or at the Shabbos table. How grateful we are to God for this. I wonder why God, or why did God do it this way? What did God have in mind? Or et cetera, or just the mystery of God, how we can't understand because there's hardship and there's suffering and there's setbacks. But we know it's good in some way. Make it part of it, because we want our kids not just to go through the motions, but to really think about God and to really have a relationship with God. And it can be a topic of conversation, and bring it to the Shabbos table. I want to give you an example which I had recently, or for my work I did, and it shows how when you model something, how children can pick up on it. Some of you may have been aware, although it's not really from our community, one of the things I do, which was not mentioned, is I run the Bereavement and Crisis Intervention Department of Chai Lifeline. Unfortunately, if there's a disaster, if there's a tragedy, we're pretty much the ones who come down. I have people work under me and attend to it and help the family, help the community, the school, et cetera. I've been in different places and different unforeseen circumstances. This past Sukkot, Chol HaMoed, there was a young fourth grade boy in Williamsburg from the Satmar community who was run over and killed in Williamsburg. It was in the papers, and if you heard about it, not whatever. And once, you know, of course we helped the family out, but we, you know, when school resumed, I have a member of my team who is a Hasidish guy whom I have trained, and he went down to the classroom to help the students with this tragedy, a loss of a classmate. And he's talking to the kids, and one of the things he's saying to the kids is that there's something you can do, li'ilui nefesh. You know, you can take on something to commemorate and to remember your friend and classmate. What do you think you could do? He said to these fourth grade boys. So the boys are raising their hand. Yeah, we can say Tehillim, we can learn more, we can speak less Lashon Hara, whatever, you know. So one guy raises his hand and says, what about a gemach? A charitable organization. Gemach typically is Elon Money or something like that. But fourth graders, where did they come up with the idea of a gemach? He was a little taken aback. He said, what do you have in mind? So the boy told him that this Nebuch, this boy who was run over, was his partner, and they had a gemach that they would bring extra school supplies to school. They would bring extra pencils and paper and glue and things like that. And if a kid in the school forgot some supplies, they would loan it to him. And he would bring it back the next day and pay them back. And they had this gemach in the school. So he said, A, he needs a new partner, and he wants to name the gemach after this boy. That's fourth graders. And I can assure you that that kid sees chesed at home. He sees his parents loaning, he sees his parents going out of his way, and that's integrated and taken in by the children. I thank you for listening. We have a few minutes.